Hi, and welcome to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. I'm Chris Garlock. This week, we go west featuring two labor shows based out of West Coast radio station. Workweek Radio on KPOO in San Francisco, and Labor Radio on KBOO in Portland, Oregon.
We need to find a fight for the new future in support of this new vision that another world is possible.
That's actor and activist Danny Glover on Workweek Radio, which also features Professor William Robinson, connecting coronavirus and capitalism and how this epidemic has escalated the contradictions and attacks on the working class.
This pandemic is life and death. It's not for you, for your coworker, for your family, for their family, for our customers.
And that's Jamie Partridge of Communities and Postal Workers United on Labor Radio, which included an excerpt from this year's online Labor Notes conference with comments by Gia Lee of the Movement of Rank and File Educators at the United Federation of Teachers and Stacey Davis Gates of the Chicago Teachers. Plus, we've got the Fight for Equality from Labor History in Two, a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Enjoy the show.
This is KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM and KPOO.com on the internet.
Forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walks up and said, this is a union town, a union
town. This is Steve Zelser with Workweek. Workweek, on our second hour, we'll hear from UCSB Professor William Robinson about how the coronavirus has escalated the crisis of capitalism and what this means for the working class in our new world situation. With a likely 30 to 35 million unemployed, how will working people survive during this pandemic? In a system based on profiteering and on the billionaires getting even more wealthy as they take advantage of people losing their homes and everything else. Next, we will hear from a presentation by actor and activist Danny Glover. He spoke at ILW Local 34 during Black History Month. Now to our program. The crisis of coronavirus, which is now enveloping the world, creating a catastrophe economically and healthcare, and the loss of potentially millions of working people around the world, a devastating situation, not only for the working class and the people of the world, but also it has exposed the nature of capitalism and the crisis of capitalism and what that means for capitalism today. With the potential of 30 million to 40 million people out of work, this is going to raise new questions about how society is organized, how it should be reorganized to defend working people here and around the world. And joining us on Workweek is William Robinson, who is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's an upcoming book he's written called The Global Police State will be published by Pluto in 2020 in July. And also he's been an expert on the role of NAFTA and the role of United States and multinationals in Mexico. Welcome to Workweek, William.
Pleasure to be on.
So, William, you've written an article and done some examination about the corona crisis and the crisis of global capitalism. What is the new world situation with global capitalism and the relationship of coronavirus to that crisis?
Well, we need to be clear that all the virus did is trigger a crisis that was waiting to happen. This is a chronicle foretold. Global capitalism has been a deep crisis, and I think we need to point out three dimensions of that crisis. One is ecological, and I'm not going to go into that now, but the system has been facing a structural crisis, which I'll get into in just a moment, and this was simply pushed it over the edge. This was going to happen anyway, an economic implosion, a financial implosion. And secondly, the system has been facing a mounting crisis of state legitimacy and of capitalist hegemony. And the coronavirus right now is going to aggravate both of those dimensions of the crisis.
And the debt that the United States was in from 2008, what happened in 2008 and what are its ramifications today?
Sure. Well, let's step back a minute and say, what is the nature of the crisis, of the economic crisis, the structural crisis that led to 2008 and that we're seeing deepening and unfolding right now? And that's what we call in political economy overaccumulation. It's not so hard to grasp this concept. Basically, capitalists do whatever they can to maximize their own profit and minimize labor costs. And so global inequality has been intensifying over the last 30, 40 years because of capitalist globalization and because of the neoliberal model. Everyone is familiar with this data, that 1% of humanity has over 50% of the world's wealth, and 20% of humanity, that affluent portion of humanity, has 95% of the world's wealth. So 80% of humanity is left with just 5% of the world's wealth. Under those conditions, the global economy pours out all of this goods and services, this incredible ability to produce wealth, but it cannot be absorbed by the global market. And so that is the very essence of the structural crisis, that is it. That's what we call overaccumulation. Corporations, transnational corporations, are awash in profits. They've accumulated trillions of dollars in profits, but they cannot profitably reinvest those profits because the market cannot absorb productive output. So what has what I call the transnational capitalist class, they're the ones that run the transnational corporations and the financial institutions, they're the rulers of the world. And so what have they been doing even prior to 2008? They've been directing their trillions of dollars in wealth towards financial speculation above all. And that financial speculation finally collapsed in 2008 with the mortgage crisis. And the second thing that they have been doing is sustaining growth in the face of stagnation through ever-rising amounts of debt, consumer debt, state and government debt, and corporate debt. So what happened in 2008? The U.S. government massively bailed out the banks and bailed out the corporations. That we all know. And in fact, there's a little-known piece of data, and this was released by a congressional investigation, so it's not just a leftist assumption, that $17 trillion was spent in bailing out the global banks and corporations in 2008. But here's the thing. What did they do from 2008 to 2020? They didn't take all of that bailout money and reinvest it in productive and employment-creating opportunities. They simply recycled that into more financial speculation, into endless financial speculation. So here's a piece of data which listeners, it's hard to even wrap your mind around this piece of data. The global economy produces the global GNP, the global product. That is, the entire global economy producing goods and services, $75 trillion annually. Yet global financial speculation is over a quadrillion dollars. Just in derivatives, it was $1.2 quadrillion in 2018. So look at that. The real economy produces $75 trillion worldwide in goods and services. Speculative economy is over a quadrillion dollars. That's this enormous gap. And that gap had to pop. It had to break. You couldn't continue with that type of a gap between the real world economy that we all depend on and this fictitious economy of a global casino. And so that's in 2008, but it would have happened in 2019, 2020, 2021 with something else. It was just by chance this coronavirus which triggered that collapse. Now, there's a second dimension, too, that I want to emphasize. The other thing that has kept the global economy going since the 2008 collapse and even before then has been credit. Consumer credit just in the United States has already $17 trillion, its highest than it's ever been, and all around the world, in the rich countries, but even throughout the big countries of the global south, in China, in India, and Brazil, consumer credit is reaching the maximum point, consumer debt. And any default on consumer debt will also throw the economy into, global economy into a tailspin, and people can no longer take on any more debt. So in any case, the global economy faces deep structural crisis. And anything would have been the trigger. It simply happened to be the virus.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with William Robinson, a professor at University of California at Santa Barbara, and he's been examining the coronavirus and what it will do to global capitalism and what it means for the working class of the United States and the world. So thanks for joining us on Work Week, William.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Look at
the bandits plunder the planet. How can you stand it? Don't it make you real mad? You know we've been had. We better rock the big boat. Look what's been won with war and with guns. All it's done is bring on more hate. It's getting late. We better rock the big boat. Look at the hunger.
We will now hear from actor and activist Danny Glover, who spoke during Black History Month on the struggles of blacks, workers in the United States and internationally.
In some ways, even though our memories become short when we get a little bit older, I remember the Union Hall being the hall where, as a kid in high school, we would, a group of us would get up early in the morning and we would make our way down here with our Social Security cards in hope of getting some work that day as casuals on the banana boats that would come through here. When we think about what is happening around the world, it pales in so many ways in contrast to what is happening here. Often what we see that happens around the world, the neoliberal policies and everything else begin somewhere else. And then they manifest themselves in terms right here in our own lives, slightly altered in some sense, but they function out. And then part of that is how do you now change the trajectory of what is happening in those generational struggles? What are those struggles for independence, struggles for self-determination in other places here as well? We would just witness what was happening just a few years ago in Latin America, where we see it from the bottom up, we saw something extraordinary. Some people said it was the best thing that happened, the most amazing thing that happened since the conquistadors. And we were talking about the struggles for self-determination and also grassroots politics, whether they're in Brazil or whether they were in Venezuela, whether they were in Argentina, whether they were in Uruguay, whether they were in wherever they were, whether they were in Ecuador. We were talking about that. And we saw that as some sort of light in terms of developing the different relationships on with nation-to-nation relationships. We can talk about what was happening in Venezuela and talk about the ideas of Petrocaribe and providing discount oil, not only to countries in the Caribbean community, but also even providing discount oil for citizens in the Bronx. We're in the midst of this right now, and I believe a generational shift right here. And the discussion is much larger than we are is able to contextualize in the media itself. We see what is happening here with young people, in a sense, who believe that there's no future. They're working several jobs and everything to keep themselves going. They're able to buy a home, they're able to start a future, and all those particular things. And for the first time since somewhere long before this became a powerful nation, we have succeeding generations that feel as if they are unable to realize the gains that their parents, and before them, their parents' parents were able to gain. So that's real. And we can often call it the American dream, but is that what we want to say about what the American dream is? Has American dream that we perceive been at the expense of other people in the world and other movements in the world? That's a major question we have to ask ourselves. Sometimes we become so self-indulgent in who we are and what we do and everything else that we don't realize the impact that what we do has on the rest, not only us, ourselves, but also on other people in the rest of the world. So we're going to have to understand that relationship. We talk about the idea of globalization, but that globalization doesn't reach out as it had been in the past. You look at moments, the great moment that Buzz talked about in relationship to the 1934 strike. That was a strike that, in a sense, had international overtones as well. It also clearly gave a statement about the relationship that workers had and the radicalization of that relationship in a radical moment and how those workers, how they exercise their power in that particular moment. It won great benefits, that strike. Not only there was a precursor to the New Deal, one of the obvious benefits of that strike, but there were other things that came as a reward of that. By the end of World War II, because of just by the presidential decree, 8802, just by that, there were more than 40% of the workforce in the private sector were unionized by the end of the war. So we move into the next half of the 20th century with the kind of energy and power that we could exert our will within that. And we had at the same time, there were movements of winning around the world. The Vietnamese were about ready to defeat the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. The Chinese Revolution had happened. And all those things gave our sense that the world was changing and the possibilities of a different world and the different citizens in the world and taking responsibility for ourselves as citizens was changing at the well. We were born into that. Most of us here were born into that right here, born into some point within that whole process itself. Then you have the civil rights movement, more generational shifting that's happening. The civil rights movement, where young people began to say, we're going to transform the South. Whether it was the sit-ins in 1960s, whether it was in the Freedom Rides, whether it's in the voter registration, whether it's Freedom Summer 1964, all those were engines. And then emerging out of that form of realizing and reimagining democracy in itself comes the Black Power Movement. Another form in which the reimagining of power and reimagining what the possibilities would happen if there was community control of police, if there was free breakfast, if there were schools that really educated our children, if there were jobs, real jobs. And certainly, those are the kind of things that we found ourselves, and those movements were crushed at the same time. Either people were bought out or they were eliminated. Bought out or eliminated. So we're in this particular moment right now where that question that King asked in 1963, as he came out of Chicago, after spending in Chicago, where do we do go from now at this point? Chaos, a community. And right now, we have the possibility within another generational shift. Right now, young people who are part of this, there's always young people. There were young people who marched from village to village and trumpeted the idea of decolonization. There were young people who were in the streets here, and young people at any point, whether they revolted in Detroit, whether they revolted in Watts, whether they revolted in Newark, wherever they revolted, there were young people out there who were saying, we want justice now. And now while we have, at this particular point, of the work that we need to do, and those of us who have been on the battle line, whether it's through the ILWU, this local and 34 and the locals all over the country, whether it's been all up and down the coast here from Washington all the way down to San Pedro right here, you've always been here. And we need your presence here at this particular moment. We need to find a fight for the new future, given that we have a matter that you have so many issues that we need to deal with, whether it's global warming and climate change, whether it's education, whether it's reality of creating jobs, whether it's the new Green Deal. All those things are the things that are important right now. And I know, as it's happened in the past, the ILWU is going to be there. And they're going to be there in support of what is justice, and we're going to be there in support of this new vision that another world is possible.
This has been Work Week Radio on KPOO San Francisco. Thanks to our line operator, Cosme Torrey. You can reach Work Week at labormedia@gmail.com. You can also find us on SoundCloud at Work Week Radio. Solidarity has no borders.
Memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day of an important victory for any woman in the United States with a pension. The Supreme Court handed down its decision in a case known as Los Angeles Water Department versus Manhart. Manhart and a group of current and past female employees at the department had sued. The women were required to pay more into their pension than were the men. The reason for this policy was that women lived longer on average. That meant that the 2,000 women employed at the water department had to contribute nearly 15% more than their 10,000 male co-workers. The women argued that this violated Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibited discrimination based on gender. The case wound its way through the court system. The ACLU filed a brief in support of the women's cause at the U.S. Supreme Court. The women won their case in a 6-2 decision. The majority of justices decided that even if women lived longer than men as a group, it would be impossible to know how long each individual woman might live. Therefore, individual women could not be held to a different standard for their pensions. The case was an important affirmation of the protections of the Civil Rights Act. Yet despite this victory, the women were not returned any of the extra money they had been required to pay into their pensions. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, writing for the majority, found that such retroactive payments could be, quote, devastating for a pension fund. He wrote that, quote, administrators of retirement plans must be given time to adjust gradually to Title VII's demands. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. This is Jamie Partridge, your co-host for this evening. Amanda Hill is not with us this evening, and we have a special broadcast, which comes from the Labor Notes Conference. Every 2 years, Labor Notes Conference in Chicago, although this year it was not in Chicago, it was virtual, and we'll hear from several speakers that were on the plenary of that conference last weekend. Beginning with Al Bradbury, who is the director of Labor Notes.
Welcome to the first ever virtual Labor Notes Conference. My name is Alexandra Bradbury. I'm the editor and co-director of Labor Notes, the voice of rank-and-file activists who want to put the movement back in the labor movement. Whether you're part of a union or a worker center or organizing under your own steam, if you are doing your part to build a fighting labor movement that is led from the bottom up, Labor Notes is your home base. We publish a magazine and website, labornotes.org, where you can read our current coverage and how workers are fighting back. And if you have your own story to tell, we'd love to hear from you. We're also a training resource and an organizing network. We put on big events like this one and our local troublemaker schools, smaller events throughout the year, which not only teach organizing skills, but also make connections so that workplace activists can get to know each other within the same union and across unions, within the same industry and across industries, within the same city and across the world, so we can learn from each other and inspire each other, back each other up, lend each other solidarity, and build a movement together for a better world. A few months ago, no one could have predicted how different today would be from the conference that we had spent the past year planning. This is a scary and disorienting time. Already, we have lost people to the virus, including loved ones and coworkers and union siblings of some of you who are participating on this call today, and including some wonderful workplace activists and shop stewards who had planned to be with us at this year's Labor Notes Conference. But during this hard time, the place where I am finding hope is in the courage and clarity of so many workers who are organizing together to defend themselves and their communities and to transform the conditions that have made this event so disastrous, to fix what's broken so that we never allow such a thing to happen again. You're going to hear from some of those people today. So let's get to it. Moderating our plenary session is the fantastic Stacey Davis Gates, Vice President of the Chicago Teachers Union. You saw her speaking truth to power during the union's two-week strike last fall, and she and the rest of the Chicago teachers haven't let up during this crisis. Please welcome Stacey Davis Gates.
Hey, thank you all for joining us today. You know, first, you know, I want to honor those workers who have given their lives, who are essential, who have been on the front lines, who we've lost. And I just want to take a moment to honor their sacrifice, their work, and their memory. So if we could all just mute ourselves for a moment. Thank you. Today, we are going to have a fantastic panel. Workers in the movement who are leading fights in their different industries. We know beyond this moment is our desire to not return to normal. Normal is a place that de-emphasizes workers, that de-emphasizes workers of color, women workers, frontline workers. It is a space that believes in austerity, believes in gratifying the wishes of billionaires and wealthy corporations and leaving us behind. COVID-19 has put a light on the necessity of strong labor unions that can both protect, support, but also expand the vision of radical imagination. We are here today because we seek a leadership, we seek a working class that can lead in this moment. And the necessity of that leadership, safety, health and safety, making sure that the recovery that we must experience in our cities, in our states, and in this country is focused on the many. And so without any delay, I want to make sure that we begin this with the focus on how we absorb the moment, how we pivot from the pain, pivot from mourning into action. Now I'm going to move our education sector. Gia, can you offer us some words in this moment? Thank you.
Thanks, Stacey. And yeah, if anything positive has come out from this, I'd say positive is the level of awareness and our ability to be in solidarity with each other, that we're not isolated in this work, in this struggle. And my name is Gia Lee. I'm a New York City public school teacher in New York City, a member of the Movement of Rank and File Educators, which is a caucus within the United Federation of Teachers, the largest teachers union in the nation. When the pandemic started, we started to hear in our rank and file kind of informal networks that several schools across the city reported positive cases, either by family members or teachers, actual people who worked in the schools. It was reported as per policy. New York State and New York City policy report to officials who would then were supposed to close the schools for 24 hours. That did not happen. It's just coming out in the news now, but there's investigations within the Department of Education of basically telling schools that they need to be quiet about this, to not inform families, to not inform other staff members, because they didn't want to create panic. I think we're seeing the consequences to that now because of the number of cases. We're ground zero basically now for the number of unprecedented cases. We have more cases here than in many countries, just in New York City alone. Staff have passed away because of COVID-19, and several people I know of personally, I work with, colleagues in other places, have also tested positive, and that could have all been prevented. So when we started to hear this, we started to reach out to our union leadership saying we need to push the city to shut the schools down immediately. This was in the first couple weeks of March. By March 9th, nothing was happening. Our union leadership basically was quoted as saying, we in the city government are going to agree to disagree about the closure of the schools. We said that wasn't good enough. So by that Saturday, our caucus organized a citywide call in just like this. Rank and file members were saying the union leadership wasn't doing enough, the city government was not listening, and we were staging a sick out. And by Sunday evening, we heard that the mayor was going to close the schools for the week ahead. but then the mayor said all staff needed to show up to schools to report, exercise social distancing somehow, but get training through the days. I can tell you right now, nothing was prepared by the Department of Education in terms of any kinds of training. So there's all kinds of misinformation, and we're seeing the consequences of that. People were in infected buildings. I think if it weren't for our organizing of a ground up, you know, life or death situation, sick out, nothing was going to happen. I think we really put the pressure on the city government. And then as a result, we saw a 20% uptick in membership in our caucus. We're small, we're informal, and people wanted to get activated. So we formed committees, working conditions committees, regional committees across the five boroughs. And as a result, we were able to ally with other organizations, parent organizations in our city, to, you know, basically call for demands around our remote learning plans. Everything, again, was top down without any input from educators, from the families, about how things were working. So these demands became like a huge coalition building exercise for us with parent allies. And it's been incredible in terms of the level of community support and listening to each other when there's zero listening happening from the top.
If you're just tuning in, this is KBOO Portland, Labor Radio. You've been listening to the Labor Notes Conference in, well, not Chicago, actual, a virtual Labor Notes Conference last weekend.
Thank you, Gia. Gia and Kelly both provide us with some insight into how many states and municipalities will see this as an opportunity to continue to exert austerity, to continue along the lines of neoliberal policies that are both racist and sexist, that will choke the public sector in a time where we are seeing demonstrated the need for a more robust, a stronger, a well-funded public sector. Listen, COVID has destroyed communities that exist without safety nets. We see this. We can look no further than Detroit to even understand how the transit system is still being used by workers, workers in a city that is 80% Black, that is a hot spot right now with respect to COVID-19. The public sector is necessary not only for folks to have clean streets and to get around the cities, but it is necessary for the health of communities of color. And we are seeing that very clearly, which I think is a great segue to Jamie. Jamie is gonna bring us a message from the US Postal System, a space that has been marginalized over time, one that Trump is zeroing in on very clearly and sharply. Jamie, can you add to this discussion, please?
Thank you, Stacey, and Kelly and G. Let me start by saying that 8 years ago, Labor Notes helped pull together, this is in 2012, Communities and Postal Workers United, a group of rank and file activists from the four postal unions, to fight cuts, closures, delay of mail, and the ever-present privatization agenda. And this year, in mid-March, as the COVID pandemic was hitting all of us, Labor Notes again played a key role in pulling together postal worker organizers from around the country, some in Communities and Postal Workers United, and others from the vast Labor Notes network. Alex Fields, a rural letter carrier in Knoxville, Tennessee, in conversation with coworkers, launched an online petition for personal protective equipment, hazard pay, emergency leave. The petition got 50,000 signatures within 24 hours, 31,000 postal workers. So Alex reached out to Al Bradbury and the Labor Notes, and she helped bring in others like myself, and we launched a postal worker Facebook group, which immediately gained 8,000, now nearly 20,000 postal workers. And we held a series of Zoom calls organized by Labor Notes, about 100, 200 on each call. And while the Facebook page's purpose is to discuss organizing for safety and workers' rights, much of the posting is postal workers sharing their fear and desperation being on the front lines, of mourning the mounting deaths among postal workers, primarily almost exclusively black and brown postal workers, but lots of motivational and, you know, humorous, uplifting posts as well. At this point, we have 30 known postal worker deaths and about 2,000 positive infections confirmed. About 8,000 people are in quarantine. The epicenter, of course, is New York City. We know of one situation where postal workers, where letter carriers refused to go to work when they heard that there was a positive infection in their facility. Many plants and offices are at 50% or 75% out, called out after COVID confirmations, especially when management does not clean, deep clean the facility. Mail is not being delivered in some New York City neighborhoods. I just saw an article today, people not getting mail for a week. In Michigan, mail is being delivered alternate days. So in this situation, we're making frequent use of polls in our Facebook, on our Facebook page, to determine the key problems that are widely and deeply felt by postal workers. And the issue that has risen to the top recently is the fact that the authorities, management, postal nurses, CDC, the health authorities, they hide and delay information about who is sick and who should quarantine. So we devised an emergency plan based on Labor Notes, Secrets of a Successful Organizer principles for postal workers who are not accustomed to organizing. Our unions, our national unions, are primarily servicing and business unions, by and large. So we put together this emergency plan for organizing your facility for safety in the versus COVID-19. And it basically goes like this. You talk to everyone, because everyone can get infected and everyone can be exposed. You must find an organizer in each department, workstation, aisle, shift, ideally one organizer for every 10 workers. That's your organizing committee. And then each organizer has organizing conversations with each one of the workers that they're responsible for. And that consists of agitating, explaining, and asking. So you agitate, this pandemic is life and death. It's not for you, for your coworker, for your family, for their family, for our customers. Explain the plan. Everybody gets on a text message group, WhatsApp or whatever works for your department, for the organizing committee. Everyone agrees to report if they have symptoms. Everyone agrees to investigate who is in close contact with the infected coworker. Everyone who is in close contact agrees to immediately self-quarantine for 14 days and insists that management deep clean the facility. Don't wait. Work out the paperwork later. Don't wait for testing, doctor's orders, CDC, local health authorities, the postal nurse, leave, type of leave, notifying management. Act now, rely on yourselves. Okay, ask. Agitate, explain, ask. Are you in? Will you be part of this text network? You know, and get from each person their name, their worksite, their shift, and their telephone number for the text network. That's the plan. And the follow-up, of course, is when a coworker gets symptoms, did they report to all? Did the contact self-quarantine? Did management deep clean? Did management retaliate? You know, who needs to talk to whom to strengthen the solidarity? And then the question also out there is, do we need to organize to refuse to work in dangerous conditions if management doesn't deep disinfect? And then, of course, keep the network together for the next struggle. That's the positive outcome. And we know that this emergency plan is being used in some work sites and in other essential industry workplaces. Labor Notes put it on the website, which was great. Let me just finish up by saying that in the past 2 weeks, after another poll on Facebook, we've pivoted to pushing our national unions to take up the hazard pay emergency leave for all affected by the virus and funding for the Postal Service. Funding because letter volume has dropped like 30% in the last month. It'll be down 50% by summer. The Postmaster General says that Postal Service will be out of money by fall. So we organized a letter signed by 200 union representatives, 15 local presidents, calling on our union leaders to mobilize our members in this fight, similar to what the nurses are doing. You know, currently we're being told to write Congress. Not enough. The Trump administration will undoubtedly take this opportunity to push its privatization agenda. Stay tuned to engage with us in that fight. Mourn the dead, fight like hell for the living.
Thank you, Jamie. One of the things that Jamie makes very clear to us is the necessity of having a well-organized rank and file. This is not a movement that will be led solely by leadership. The union is all of us. And if the union is all of us, we have to activate appropriately. We have to create spaces via Zoom, via Google, via conference call to make sure that our membership understands the stakes. In many of our industries right now, the support, the protection, the foresight, the courage of unions is a life and death situation. And we have to take it very seriously, and we have to have a very sharp, clear set of demands, not only for this moment, but how we reimagine going back into some of our workspaces.
And that wraps it up for this evening's Labor Radio. Let me remind all our listeners that KBOO.FM is where you can go to make a contribution to this community radio station, which is volunteer run and listener supported. We didn't have our spring membership drive this year, so if you're not yet a member, or if it's time to renew, kboo.fm. And that's it for tonight. Every Monday night at 6 p.m. and stay tuned to Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. We hope you've enjoyed these highlights from Labor Radio and podcast shows around the country, part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network of shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly is produced and mixed by me. Our social media guru is Harold Phillips. You can reach us at laborradionetwork.org.